fascinated by all of the historical issues that are coming up with regards to Tulsa and Black Wall Street. I'm fascinated because as more and more people are learning about it, there is this vibrant discussion that's going on with regards to what parts of our history we don't know about. And let me tell you why Tulsa's situation is so profound for me, because as now you're hearing about Tulsa, you're also hearing about Wilmington, North Carolina. You're starting to hear about Elaine, Arkansas. You're starting to hear about Rosewood. Now, mind you, I knew about Rosewood. I was familiar with Tulsa to a degree. I didn't know about Wilmington. I didn't know about Elaine. And I'm embarrassed about Elaine because I'm from Arkansas. But what's happening is that a lot of times is that whenever we have these significant situations like this is the 100-year anniversary of what happened. I mean, we should never, it's never an anniversary to celebrate. You want to thank goodness that there are people who did survive of such a, of the Tulsa massacre, that it's important to understand that as we hear this story, we start hearing other stories about our history that's important, which made me stop and go back and look at my own individual history. And let me tell you a couple, just two particular situations that I found out recently that had me looking and going, man, I really wish I would have known that growing up. First, the KKK marches through Black communities after their rallies. Now, we've probably seen countless videos of rallies of KKK and burning crosses and people wearing sheets and so forth. And so that's not new from a historical standpoint. But how many of you are aware that the KKK, and you may have been aware, and God bless you, I didn't know this, even though it's not a shocker when I found this out. But how many of you are aware that it wasn't a fairly common phenomenon, or wasn't uncommon, for once the KKK had their rallies, that they would typically march kind of like in a parade style through Black communities? Think about the profoundness of this. And this is where it's amazing when I start listening to people and I keep thinking, dude, you do realize this went well into the 60s and so forth. We're not even a full, we're barely over 50 years removed from when activities like this were a fairly common occurrence. Well, why is that important to me? Well, I recently spoke to my uncle who mentioned to me in my hometown that that's what would happen. That literally what would happen. It was fairly well known. The Klan would have this big rally in this big open area. I know the area because it's now a mall. And then afterwards, they literally would get in their trucks and everything like that, and kind of parade style, they would ride and walk through Black communities. And I was like, and of course, that mind blew me. And then, a couple of weeks later, I spoke to my wife's aunt, who told me that in Augusta, Georgia, similar thing, meaning they would have these big rallies, and then after they did their rallies, they would go through the Black areas of Augusta, and it was fairly known that when they came through, you turned off all your lights and you put your covers down and you stay quiet. The perception is, of course, you don't want to do anything to cause attention where they may feel the need to come and take a particular course of action. Now, I say that because think about how profound that is to be in a community. And this is a situation where, you know, my wife, you know, I'm a young man of a certain age. My wife grew up during that time. So we're talking my generation still experienced something like that. I mean, think about that for a second. For those persons who want to rush to say, oh, we're ignoring the progress. I'm like, nobody's ignoring the progress, but we cannot ignore the fact that there was a segment of our population who were okay terrorizing people regularly. And those people are still alive. That's one. And two, the people who they did that to are still alive. And three, the people that they can share that information to are still alive. So that happened to my wife's aunt, my uncle, my mom. They experienced that. They told that to me. And that gave me a perspective that I did not have. Which then gets me to my second historical point. Student Nonviolent Coordinative Committee and my Uncle Jay Jr., who is a dentist. I found out like maybe a few months ago that he was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinative Committee, or SNCC. For those of you who've never heard of SNCC, Google it, research it. But SNCC, among a few other things, were known for their activities. They were very prominent in a lot of the marches. If you think about the sit-ins, that was their biggest. That was their big thing. They were actively participating with the Freedom Riders with regard to voter registration. And so when you see a lot of the videos of the dogs attacking and so forth and the water hoses, those are students. A lot of times, they're either church people from the Southern Coast Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, or SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinated Committee. These are students, kids. And When I saw these, my mother once told me the story about how she had a chance to march with them and they educated her to all kinds of things. I thought that was cool. Never dawned on me that I had a family member who was a part of that and who actually participated in a sit-in. I was like, what the heck? And in my hometown, because Woolworths was the place back in the day and where you basically had they were part of the store. There was part of it. There was a sit-down restaurant where you could actually go and order, coffee and drink and food. And of course, blacks couldn't sit there at the time. And in my hometown, that's exactly what he did. He actually sat at a counter with fellow students, got spit on, stuff poured on him in the whole nine. And I never knew that. Yeah, my uncle, God bless him, he has Alzheimer's now, so I can't really ask him. But I'm sitting here going, I had no clue. I had no clue that my uncle was a member of, not only a member of SNCC, but actually participated in a SNCC and actually participated in a sit-in and could actually tell me real time. Because when you see video images and so forth, see, and this is one of the things that's kind of damaging about videos. Because once you see a video or movie of something, black and white or grainy color from back in the day, it's easy to have a disconnect to say, oh, that was then, this is now. This is someone I grew up with who I view as a mentor. He's in my fraternity. I mean, he's one of the reasons I pledged my fraternity. I mean, I used to spend summers at his house with his kids because I was close to them and I was close to him. I mean, he gave me guidance when I was running my own law firm. I mean, this is a guy who's been a mentor all my life, and it never crossed my mind to even ask him his involvement in the civil rights movement, and I never knew that he actually did. So why am I sharing this? What it's about now is making sure our stories get told. Because unfortunately, and I've talked about this, is that history tends to be presented as an overview, not as an accurate recollection of what actually happened. Mainly because there is so much of it that people who are often presenting history, especially in the secondary arena, like kindergarten through K-12, you can't hit it all. So what ends up happening is you start identifying specific things that you want to bring to people's attention as a foundation. The problem is that when you take that approach, things get left out. And as a result of things getting left out, the contextual importance of it or the gleaning message you can get from that gets lost. Our stories need to be told, because as we start losing these generations, our ability to capture the stories of these generations go with them. And their contributions to the overall story is just as important. The reality is that there are so many components to history that it's important that we get all those components, so this way the story can be presented fully and not partially. Safety and health specialist, as well as an industrial hygiene officer, and as well as someone with a master's degree in public health aspect, and as somebody who is an attorney and who used to practice law for over 15 years, my philosophy is that it's not really life after COVID. COVID's not going anywhere. There's a couple of perspectives that I want you to keep in your mind when going forward in terms of what is the public health perspective and the legal perspective of our new COVID world. First, it's important to remember, and we've been told this countless times, receiving of the vaccine is designed to do a variety of things. One, it's designed to, one, increase our immunity against COVID-19. Two, it is designed to, of course, reduce or eliminate the potential severe symptoms that you may be subjected to it. And three, it may reduce the likelihood of you spreading the disease to others. But from a public health standpoint, and this is one of the things that I tell people when people ask me about it from a public health standpoint, I'm like, listen, part of your public health aspect is a global approach. Because ultimately what you're trying to do is you're trying to reduce the amount of exposures to a particular illness. So what does that mean for us going forward? That when trying to reduce the number of illnesses, that your exposures to illnesses, you have to take in the entire population, not just a segment of the population. And so as a result, what happens is not only do you take in consideration the people who get vaccinated, who are able to now maneuver in a particular way, you also have to take in consideration the other population, the population of people who have made the decision that they're not going to get the vaccination and who have made the decision that their various exposures to this illness is not as significant to them as other persons. Now, again, I'm not here to criticize anyone's choice. You have to be mindful, and this is from a public health standpoint, that because of the fact that you have a segment of the population that may deviate from doing those things that may reduce the amount of exposure of the illness to others, you have to factor them into what impact that's going to have on the community as a whole. And why is that important? The system as a whole, from a public health standpoint, has to adapt to the fact that any uptick in numbers, in order to reduce the exposure, you're going to have to implement controls like you were before in order to get those numbers down. But it's important to understand that when we're looking at public health is, like I said, public health is a global perspective. So that means in order to adjust for whatever happens in terms of a specific demographic, we have to take in where that weight collectively, especially in light of the fact is that we have more variants that are starting coming out, and we are now starting to find out what impact the vaccines have on these variants. As long as the vaccine continues to be an effective means of dealing with these variants, then from a public health standpoint, you're not going to have as much of a concern. They're going to keep an eye out, but just not as much of a concern because you now see that the vaccines are effective at doing what they're doing. Don't be surprised if a lot of the social safeguards that we put in place start popping back up, maybe not to the severity that they were back in March of 2020, but a variation of it. And even if the government doesn't do it, don't be surprised if employers do it, because they have to be cognizant of the fact that they have to protect their employees. Because if the numbers are going up and their employees are being exposed to people who they have no way of verifying whether or not those individuals are following the protocols, they've got to make sure they protect their people in the long run. The other side of this is the legal side. One of the things that you will find, and you probably don't know, that attorneys do is anytime there's a new situation that presents itself, there's usually an opportunity for new legal actions to pop up. Attorneys are very good about paying close attention to how a particular new set of circumstance that has a large global impact may have a potential large global legal impact. And some of you are sitting there going saying, oh, attorney just looking for a way to sue somebody. I said, well, not necessarily. They're not looking for ways to sue somebody, but part of their responsibility and part of what their job is to do is to represent the interest of people who have been harmed. And you've got to remember, we're talking about a virus that none of us saw coming that impacted us really fast and that impacted so many people globally, not locally, not nationally, globally. So as a result of this impact, there is going to be situations that present itself as a result of this that may be legal situations that attorneys are going to have to face. It could be anything from a financial standpoint. Think about the number of people who have had to file bankruptcy with regards to the fact that they couldn't go back into work because of the nature of the job that they had, the lack of income, the slowness of stimulus packages coming before them. They may find themselves having to avail the bankruptcy system, and bankruptcy attorney can talk about if the COVID situation will have any role or any impact in terms of their bankruptcy proceedings. Probate, meaning when somebody passes away, you know, those things pop into case. So cause of death may be an issue with regards to that. And that also may play a part with regards to insurance. There may be situations from an employment situation where somebody is saying that they worked for an employer who consciously put them in harm's way, did not provide them enough protective equipment, did not put enough safeguards in place to ensure they didn't get sick, and then they end up getting sick and they can chart it back to or trace it back to getting exposed to something at their workplace. And trust me when I tell you, attorneys are there to investigate all of those things, because depending on the set of facts and circumstances and the laws of those areas, those may be viable concerns. Why is this important? Because what happens is whenever you find yourself in a situation with a new set of circumstances that may give rise to a new set of legal actions, attorneys are in a unique situation of trying to not only investigate, but present cases to see whether or not this is something that can be covered. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're not totally sure if the nature of your situation there's a tie with COVID may have an impact from a legal standpoint, whether it be employment, whether it be financial, whether it be insurance, whatever the case may be, and you're not sure, reach out to an attorney. Now, I'll tell you, this is the other thing that's going to be funky, because a lot of people are going to be like, how do you look for a COVID attorney? And I'm thinking, don't look at it as a COVID. Look at it as this is my situation. look for that situation type of attorney, and then ask what impact COVID has on it. So for instance, if you have a bankruptcy case and you know that COVID played a role in that bankruptcy, you go to a bankruptcy attorney and you ask the bankruptcy attorney, this was impacted by my COVID and this is how. Is that important? All of these things are important because we are still, whether, I know it's been a year and a half, we are still fairly young in this particular thing because we don't know how long it's going to last or how devastating it's going to be impacting. And it's still devastating to this day. But from a legal standpoint and from a public health standpoint, these things are things that you need to be mindful of going forward so that you can move more fluidly in this new COVID world.